The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thanks for coming this early. I know a Sunday at the last day at 9:30 is not always most ideal. First off, you can see there are maps on all the chairs, so I'm going to be referencing a lot of things, so you can use the map or not use the map. That's up to you. So let's get right into it. So many liberals today say that Trump is taking this country down a road that it doesn't stand for. And the reality is that Trump is America. America has always been violent with its origins of stealing of land and genocidal policies towards indigenous people and the enslavement of African people and the founding ideology of white supremacy. Indigenous people have been on the front lines of these attacks ever since Europeans first stepped foot on this soil. The Osheti Sakoi, also known as the Great Sioux Nation, has been back in the news with their struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Standing Rock is in fact where Sitting Bull's people, the Hunkpapa Lakota, are from. And this is no coincidence that we're seeing the Lakota struggle today against the U.S. because there is a historical context and a historical resistance to that. In 1969, at the beginning of the Red Power Movement, the American Indian activist Vine Deloria Jr. wrote what became the handbook of American Indian activism in the 70s, called Custer Died for Your Sins. I've wanted to do a talk titled that for quite a while because it's a kind of eye-catching. The title caught the attention of the American public, with indigenous people on the streets demanding treaty rights and civil rights and against police brutality, inspired by the civil rights movement. And this book, as well as the title, kind of brought back the old myth of Custer to light. As many of you may know, George General Armstrong Custer, who is the head of the 7th Cavalry, is infamous for being an Indian hunter responsible for massacres in the name of manifest destiny. He's also very much like Trump. You know, he's kind of interested in his image. He had longer hair and was obsessed with that. And also, he had very many bad investments, much like Trump as well. So we should definitely see the similarities there. Custer is best known for dying at the Battle of Little Bighorn, also known also known as the Battle of the Greasy Green. Custer and his troops were defeated by one of the largest gatherings of indigenous people on the open plains, resisting being forced on reservations. The Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho came together in thousands and defeated Custer on that day on June 25th, 1876, a week before the 100-year celebration of the founding of this country. Which obviously was a damper for them. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were the leaders of this unification and the resistance that day. Since that day, anthropologists, historians, and many who have been searching for a reason, like, how did this happen? How could a bunch of Indians kill Custer and his modern army? What did the troops do wrong? Rather than saying they were better armed, they were better prepared, and they outnumbered them. And after that day, Custer became a myth as a heroic death in the continued invasion of indigenous homelands. He was featured in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show as a hero that day, and Custer represented the expansion of white supremacy and their God-given right to the land. America put Custer as the sacrifice for progress. On the other side, there were Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, two of the most famous Indian resistors in U.S. history. Both refused to sign treaties and refused to be put on reservations, rather to roam their country freely, hunting and living. As we saw the resistance camp at Standing Rock against DAPL, you would hear their names everywhere, see their images, well, except for Crazy Horse, who was never photographed. But these names continued to inspire resistance today. In this talk, I'm going to walk you through the history leading up to the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the context that drove everything to that moment. And I'll kind of examine quickly how the battle was kind of the peak of Indian resistance in this time period. Obviously, Indian resistance is still happening today, and quickly became the beginning of the end of the armed resistance against Manifest Destiny. But other forms of resistance obviously would continue in the early 20th century and beyond. So some of the biggest takeaways I want you all to have coming into this. So first, when we discuss the U.S. and its expansion, we refer to it as expansion rather than invasion and colonization. Rather, the U.S. military engaged in battles, treaties, and invasions of lands of other nations. This is important to understand this moment in time. The Lakota are a nation, and the U.S. invaded that nation and occupied it. These more kind of quote-unquote modern terms are useful in discussing the settler colony of the United States. And I'll be using words such as nations and countries rather than tribes for the most part in this talk. Also, the progress of invasion and occupation was not inevitable, and it did not happen without a fight. And the development of the U.S. was bloody through and through. And third, this moment at the Little Bighorn is still extremely important in the historical memory of indigenous people, and it was the largest defeat of the U.S. military until Vietnam. And finally, this fight is still happening today. Though I will be discussing the course of historical events, it's important to note that U.S. policy of extermination, whether that was the hardliners who wanted to kill every indigenous person, or it was the liberals who wanted to fully assimilate them into society, did not fully work. Indigenous people are actually still here today. If that policy did work, they would not be here today. And they're still fighting to fight for their rights of sovereignty, as well as just basic humanity. So why did the U.S. go west? The United States was founded with the idea of moving west. The Revolutionary War was fought over taking indigenous land west of the Appalachian Mountains. The British, no fans of the indigenous population, was limiting colonists from going west, and many wealthy colonists, like George Washington, had investments over the mountains. The Lewis and Clark expedition and the Louisiana Purchase were a continuation of the ideological thrust of this time period, where that white Protestants were entitled to the entire land from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The term was Manifest Destiny, which was originally coined by John O'Sullivan from the newspaper Democratic Review, stating that Americans had, quote, the right of our manifest destiny to overspread and to possess the whole continent which Providence has given us for the development of the great experiment of liberty and federated self-government. Obviously, according to the followers of this ideology, it would be taking the self-governance away of hundreds of nations. And this also played into what Thomas Jefferson would call the Empire of Liberty. This obviously was not about liberty or self-governance. This was the ideological component to give cover for the necessary capitalist expansion and the need for resources to and the building of railroads to successfully build this new empire that the U.S. was building. The U.S. was continually making and breaking treaties with various indigenous nations as they moved west, displacing indigenous people. It wasn't until the Civil War that the expansionist policy just slightly slowed down. The U.S. focused its efforts on the war, but once the war was over, the U.S. industrial North was stronger than ever, and the U.S. military was consolidated to focus its riches out west. For many newfound war heroes from the Civil War, the way that they were going to advance their career was to fight Indians on the plains. And this was the exact tradition that Custer came out of. The United States was becoming a fully capitalist country, even more powerful than they were when during the Revolutionary War. And they needed more and more resources. The only way that the wealth was made possible was based on what Karl Marx would call primitive accumulation, or primitive meaning primary or first. In the book Roots of Oppression, The American Indian Question, Steve Talbot describes this process. The European, quote, the European conquest of North America and later U.S. Westward expansion across Indian lands had its origins in the brutal process Marx termed the so-called primitive accumulation of capital. The seizure of another people's land base in the interests of colonial powers, ruling elites, and for the purpose of generating capital by transforming land base into large-scale private property. In order to take this land, slaughter, dehumanization, genocide were tools to get that large-scale property, because the Lakota and other indigenous nations were not based on private property. In essence, the deeper conflict at hand was between public and private property. So the Lakota first encountered the Wichichu, which is white in Lakota, during the Lewis and Clark expedition. Lewis described Lakota as in such vile language, describing them as the, quote, the vilest miscreants of the Indian race who must ever remain pirates of the Missouri. In fact, the Lakota were the most powerful nation in the region, now known as the Great Plains, spreading from modern-day Nebraska into the Dakotas, Montana, and Wyoming. They were at the center of the vast trade network that stretched across the plains and connected people for hundreds of miles in every direction. Oh, losing my spot here. There we go. Tim Lehman, in his book Bloodshed at the Little Bighorn, described the Lakota's journey to the plains. Quote, They lived on the plains west of the Missouri for only a few generations, lured to the region by the abundant buffalo herds that grew fat on the rich prairie grasses. Previously, they hunted deer, gathered wild rice, and trapped beavers in Minnesota, where the French dubbed them the Sioux, a translation of the Algonquin word meaning enemy. While Sioux came to be used as a widespread and seemingly indispensable collective term for these people, many of them then and now prefer to be called Dakota, Eastern Santee, or Lakota, Western or Teton, depending on the dialect, a word meaning the people or the allies in connotating friendship. The arrival of the horse out west transformed the Lakota's lifestyle and economy. It made it easier to hunt buffalo, becoming fully dependent on the animal both materially and spiritually. The horse, Shunka Wakan, became identified with the Lakota as they became great horsemen, and they came to dominate the region and the major power players in the area and as the U.S. continued to invade countries around the area. The Lakota numbered about 8 to 10,000 when they first encountered Lewis and Clark, and would grow to 16 to 20,000 by the time the Battle of the Little Bighorn. They were the only indigenous nation in the Northern Plains to grow to this population. The first treaty that the Lakota signed with the U.S. was the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851. The treaty establishes various national borders on the plains, and indigenous people agreed to not war on each other or on whites passing legally through their countries. Indigenous people recognized the right of the U.S. government to establish roads, military, and other posts. Essentially, this was a peace treaty, though, which is very clear. With that said, the treaty-making process was extremely flawed. The U.S. would often appoint someone as chief without acknowledging or conforming to the decision-making that was done in that specific nation. Oftentimes, in these treaty-making processes, the whole nation would come and discuss what were at hand and how to make decisions. But another problem was that not everyone was at these meetings. For example, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and their bands were not at these treaties and would not sign them. but the political function of the Lakota as a single chief could not enforce treaty making among all Lakota because of their decentralization. No chief could recognize obedience from the entire could require obedience from the entire band, nor could warriors be expected to turn themselves in for the judgment of a white judicial system. The U.S. manipulated the treaty process to accommodate their goals and efforts to steal land of the Lakota. Colin Galloway, in his book Pen and Ink Witchcraft, said, quote, "Treaties functioned as a stepping stones of empire. They enabled colonists to establish a foothold on the continent, colonies to expand their domains, and the United States to march westward, one chunk of territory after another." Between 1851 and the Civil War, there were battles, especially along the Bozeman Trail, which went through Lakota territories as settlers went west. Raids on settlers and native villages started. At this time, the U.S. started to try to divide. There started to be a divide within the Lakota. There were those who wanted to establish peace and saw it as the only way to survive, as they were whites were overflowing coming west. But then there was bands such as the ones that Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull led that were against the treaty and wanted to. They headed north to try to live freely on the plains. And these were the foundations of the resistance. And as I mentioned, it really wasn't until once the Civil War happened, these attacks accelerated because names that we're used to hearing as great Civil War heroes, Sherman, Sheridan, and even Custer, were made their names in the Civil War. And the only way that they saw the way to advance their personal career was to advance west as the U.S. Marched forward. And this comes in the context after the U.S. had already removed the Cherokee from the southeast, the 20-year war with the Seminoles in Florida, and the fight on the fronts in the southwest with people like the Apache, Diné, Pueblo, etc. There was indigenous resistance around the country, and this is the context that we come to. So I'm going to kind of quickly go through a little bit of a timeline to get us there. So I already mentioned the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie. 1862, there was the Dakota Uprising in Minnesota, where settlers were coming in, and the Dakota were kept on getting pushed off their land and rose up, and there was a bloody war, and at the end of it, 38 Dakota warriors were hanged by President Lincoln, the largest mass execution in U.S. history still to this day. And then 1864, the Sand Creek Massacre happened. After the hanging of these warriors in Minnesota, there was paranoia all around the U.S. The Cheyenne wanted to negotiate a treaty, but Colonel Shivington, on the brink of the massacre, said, quote, "I have come to kill Indians and believe it is the right and honorable to use any means under God's heavens to kill Indians. Damn any man who is in sympathy with an Indian." Between 150 and 200 Cheyenne were massacred that day. Two-thirds of them were women and children. In 1865, the U.S. started to negotiate almost exclusively with friendly Indians, and hostile Indians ignored what was going on, and this divide and conquer strategy that the U.S. really was implementing. 1866, the U.S. begins to negotiate with the hostile Indians, and Red Cloud and his warriors kind of continue to attack, rightfully so, on the Bozeman Trail, which was going to gold fields in Montana. And at this point, the Calvary's in a frenzy, and the what's called the Fetterman's Massacre, I would say a resistance to encroachment, takes place, in which Colonel William Fetterman and his 80 troops were killed. And this leads to the closing of the Bozeman Trail, which is put into the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, which I'll get to. But this was saw as a success by the Lakota. But to put it in greater context, this was also a competition between the developing railroad system and the trail system. So it made sense also for the U.S. to be like, okay, well, we'll close this, but we're going to be ramming through a railroad through here pretty quick. The arrival of the Northern Pacific Railroad promised to provide faster route to the Montana gold fields. In addition, as the railroads were being built, the markets for buffalo skins were increasing both in the eastern cities and and in Europe. And hunters would shoot from the trains and kill buffalo. They would take the skins and go, leave carcasses to rot. This served both as the purpose of providing for the market, but also a tool to trying to kill the Lakota's food source and force them onto reservations and become quote-unquote civilized. In 1868, the new Fort Laramie Treaty was devised, which, as I mentioned, closed the Bozeman Trail. It also created the Great Sioux Nation, which is basically all of western South Dakota of the Missouri River. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were not there. And the treaty stated, quote, no white person or persons shall be permitted to settle upon or occupy any portion of the territory or without the consent of the Indians first had and obtained to pass through. And you might be somewhat familiar with the Fort Laramie treaties, mainly because the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline has brought those to light again. The government saw this treaty as the beginning of the end of Lakota autonomy, while the Lakota viewed it as a treaty as an affirmation of their continued independence. The federal government signed these treaties before they discovered gold in the Black Hills, which is the most sacred land to the Lakota. In a Wall Street endeavor, mining companies disregarded the 1868 treaty and flooded into the area under U.S. government protection. And then also that same year, Custer makes a name for himself and engages in the Washita River Massacre in Indian Territory, known as Oklahoma today, killing Black Kettle and his band of Cheyenne. And this really establishes Custer as a great Indian fighter. 1871 is a huge blow to indigenous sovereignty as the U.S. Formally stops making treaties with indigenous nations. And then in 1873, Custer comes to the Northern Plains guarding the Northern Pacific Railroad surveyors in Montana. And in that same year, the stock market crashes and it creates a depression until 1877. And this creates an even higher sense of urgency to steal land. There you saw newspaper ads out east, Indian land for sale. And this is a point that really needs to be highlighted. The U.S. already had the ideological component, you know, racism to use to steal land and turn it into private property. And every little attack by indigenous people were viewed as savagery, though they were defending their land. And Tim Lehman commented on this, saying, quote, the financial panic, however, created an increased urgency to develop the region in the hope that an infusion of gold into the nation's economy would boost the monetary supply and stimulate the economy. While the migration of miners would serve as a safety valve to drain off the nation's unemployed workers. For a band of 15,000 or so hunters to occupy an area larger than half the state of South Dakota made no sense to white societies, anxious for economic development in every last corner of the continent. National development demanded that all available resources be exploited to their fullest potential. The economic crash happened in a perfect storm. The U.S. military was stronger than ever, and the U.S. Did not want to deal with the Lakota anymore. And the economic frenzies paired with continued development of American capitalism called for the U.S. to take resources that they needed, such as wood, gold, minerals for the development of cities in the North as slavery had just ended. In 1875, the U.S. Tries to negotiate to buy the Black Hills from the Lakota, and they say no. And then December 3rd, 1875, Edward P. Smith, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, ordered all Lakota and Cheyenne to report to reservations by January 31st, 1876, or a, quote, military force will be sent to compel them. As I mentioned, there were splits amongst the Lakota. There were those such as Red Cloud and Spotted Tail who saw it as their duty to try to form a lasting peace and thought there was no way the Lakota could win a battle against the whites at this moment in time. Both Sitting Bull, who was Hunk Papa, and Crazy Horse, who was Oglala, said no. They were from different bands of the nations, but they helped to inform. They had different skills to help to inform the resistance. Sitting Bull was a great orator. He was also a medicine man. Was able to bring bands and different indigenous nations together. While Crazy Horse was a military genius, but soft-spoken, and he would lead with his actions, and is kind of famous for, as I mentioned earlier, for never having his picture taken, which kind of adds to his reputation as this like kind of this resistance leader, and the intimidation to the whites. As the ultimatum was given, the bands were not going to head to reservations as they continued to live on the open plains in the north. The military sent Custard and others out to get the militants. Indigenous people from reservations also started to flee and meet up with Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse to live on the open, free again. But also, as a result of the reservation system, was just deplorable conditions, and there was the hope of something better. So let's talk a little bit about Custer. Custer, has, as I mentioned, has kind of built his reputation. He was in the Civil War. He was considered the boy general. He advanced pretty quickly, and also then became obviously very known as an Indian fighter. He graduated last in his class at West Point. He wrote books about his experience on the plains and how he actually kind of wanted to be an Indian, but saw it as his duty to eliminate them. He's a very confusing man. His seventh cavalry was 718 people, kind of a ragtag team. The interesting point of the military at this time period is that they were not volunteers who believed in the Civil War. They were the dredges from the Union and the Confederate armies and recent immigrants from Europe. The military out west was honestly a clusterfuck, and desertion rates after the Civil War was about one-third. Many immigrants would enter the military to get a free trip out west and then abandon to settle on land. About 50% of the military out west were actually immigrants, and many were Crow scouts as well. Basically, Custer's army was essentially a foreign legion in service of national unity. I mentioned that the Crow were the scouts for the cavalry, and this is something that usually comes on up. And the army honestly couldn't do anything really without them because they knew the land. But this obviously was a divide and conquer strategy. It's not as if the U.S. was going to take care of the Crow. They were using them to get to the Lakota. Even some of the Crow had different views of it. The great Crow chief, Plenty Coos, explained, quote, "Our decision was reached not because we loved the white man who was already crowding other tribes into our country, or because we hated the Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, but because we plainly saw that this course was the only one we might save our beautiful country for us. When I think back, my heart stings because we acted as we did. It was the only way open to us." Generally speaking, the cavalry's duty was to protect the private enterprises such as gold and the development of the railroad and protecting these new settlers that were doing their bidding. It was not about defense. It was the U.S. on the offensive invading people's countries. So in 1876, as I mentioned, the ultimatum was issued to Indians to report to reservations immediately or be considered hostile. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse with the Northern Cheyenne and Arapaho had 10,000 people, one of the largest gatherings of Indians on the in Northern America. By early June, nearly 350 lodges of other tribes had joined the approximately 150 lodges of the Hunkpapa to form a northern alliance of almost 500 lodges with at least 1,000 fighting men, and more agency Indians were arriving daily. Sitting Bull, the leader of the new alliance, went to the hilltop to pray and seek guidance from Wankatanka, also known as the Great Mystery. He prayed, quote, "Wankatanka, save me and give me all my game animals and have them close enough so my people will have enough food this winter, and also the good men on earth will have more power so their tribes get along better and be of good nature, so all the Sioux nations get along well. If you do this for me, I will Sundance 2 days and two nights and will give you a whole buffalo." This large encampment was seeking peace, but was ready to fight if it came to that. This camp performed a Sundance, one of the most sacred ceremonies that is still performed to this day. In a Sundance, you will dance around a pole or a tree while looking into the sun until you are induced into a trance. And this is performed for hours. And Sitting Bull had a vision where he saw dead soldiers on the battlefield. As this was happening, three columns were sent by General Sheridan to go compel the militants to move onto reservations. General Crooks was the largest with his army of 1,000 cavalrymen. He tried to recruit Oglalas from the agencies, but was unsuccessful. And on June 15th, he recruited 86 Shoshone and 175 Crow warriors, now with a force of over 1,300 men. They set out towards the Rosebud River. Scouts saw Crook's forces coming. Scouts saw Crook's forces coming, riding through the night. Crazy Horse led his warriors to fend them back and push them back. Wooden Leg, a Cheyenne warrior, described this battle as a series of, quote, "charges back and forth. Our Indians fought and ran away, fought and ran away. The soldiers and their Indian scouts did the same. Sometimes we chased them, sometimes they chased us." This became known as the Battle of the Rosebud. Crook was fortunate to not be completely wiped out like Custer was soon to be, and retreated back to Fort Fetterman. As Crook retreated, the Northern Alliance grew to 1,000 lodges and as many as 2,000 fighting men. Indigenous people were fleeing the agency every day to join the resistance after Rosebud, and the camp was feeling supremely confident. Columns started leaving Fort Abraham Lincoln in central North Dakota. General Terry and Custer left from here with the intention to meet up with Crook and fight the Northern Alliance. They were simply hunting Indians. Private Windolph, part of the column, summarized their situation. Quote, "We were Indian hunting in rolling mountainous country. Far removed from all civilization, we knew that west of us there was a considerable force of hostiles, but we had little accurate knowledge of how many warriors we would meet or whether they would run or fight. Custer and most of us thought they would have to whip somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500, and they expected most of them to be poorly armed and poorly led. From experience, they figured the Indians would fight only a rear guard action while the women and children, old men and pony herds got away. This seemed routine." Terry told Sheridan, quote, "No doubt of the ability of my column to whip all the Sioux we can find." The arrogance reinforced thinking that somehow these savages were not prepared and could not strategize on how to fight this army. Terry Gibbons, Reno, and Custer's columns reconvened at the Powder River with the plan to move forward. Their plan was to meet up on June 26. The idea was to find the camp and attack it from one angle and surround it and make sure no one got away. Terry and Gibbons' last words to Custer was, quote, "Now, Custer, don't be greedy, but wait for us." Custer and Reno got to the encampment and wanted to catch it by surprise and sent Reno and Bateen columns into the camp while Custer went around to make sure no one would escape. On the flip side of your map, there's some interesting stuff, so you know. scouts all protested the attack as they said there were too many and they must wait. One of the scouts said that if they started attacking, quote, "they would both wake up in hell the next morning." A Crow scout said, quote, "Do not divide your men. There are too many of the enemy for us. Even if we stay together, if you must fight, keep us all together." Custer simply responded, quote, "You do the scouting, and I will attend to the fighting." Reno's forces would be attacked first and were overwhelmed and pushed back by the large resistance. Sitting Bull did not fight as he was too old and weak from the Sundance, but Crazy Horse was the main leader on the ground from a strategic standpoint. James Welsh explains Crazy Horse military method. This is a little bit of a longer quote, but it's important. Quote, "Crazy Horse also had an idea about how to fight the soldiers, and this idea led to the Indians to success in both the Battle of the Rosebud and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. It was a simple idea, but the effect was evident. Prior to these two battles, the Indians tended to circle around the enemy on their horses and provide of their horses a moving circle, offering themselves as targets to sharpshooters and making it difficult for warriors themselves to get off accurate shots. Crazy Horse early on saw the flaw of this maneuver, and he generally stopped, even got off his horse to get a killing shot in. Now he and the war chiefs managed to hold the warriors in check, then sent them forth in waves from several directions, directly at the soldiers, attack and retreat, until the soldiers were fighting in smaller groups, each group defending a smaller part of the battlefield. By retreating, the Indians managed to draw some of these groups forward, thus exposing them to attack from a different angle. Although Indians did not kill off all of these soldiers, they kept them on the defensive and much of the time. Consequently, this dealt a serious blow to morale, to the experience of Indian fighters, and stopped them dead in their tracks. Essentially, guerrilla warfare. As you can clearly see, Indians did not just win because Custer's own incompetence, but because they were prepared and had a strategy. I won't get into the details of the battle, but simply put, Custer was killed along with 263 U.S. soldiers and only 40 indigenous people. This was a major blow to the U.S. and was the largest defeat of the U.S. At this moment. And it was a moment of pride for indigenous people coming together to defeat the U.S. Army. However, this was also the beginning of the end. The Northern Alliance split up and scattered the plains, and after that moment, the U.S. was even more bloodthirsty than ever. 1877, Sitting Bull fled to Canada, and Canada welcomed him, and before they later kicked him out. And after various skirmishes in the Black Hills, Crazy Horse turned himself in and was killed at Fort Robinson, now Nebraska, just south of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, after he surrendered. And that same year, the Black Hills were officially stolen. And then 1881, Sitting Bull returned from Canada. And then he was allowed to stay on the Standing Rock Reservation. 1887, the Dawes Act passed, which privatized Lakota land. And in 89, the U.S. breaks the Lakota Reservation to what it looks like now. And in 1890, the Ghost Dance movement starts trying to bring back the old ways. But Sitting Bull that year is killed by the Indian police, by an Indian police officer, and the massacre at Wounded Knee happens, marking the end of the Indian Wars, though it continues to this day. After this moment in history, the myth of Custer and his noble quest to move west was etched in the memory of the people of the U.S. Along with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Lincoln, are part of the identity of the U.S. And the U.S. survived day after day with this myth. Custer was part of that myth, creating the empire of liberty and freedom. The reality is that Custer, much like many and probably all of the founding fathers, established their wealth and through blood, not liberty. And the reality is that in the end, many white settlers did not even reap the benefits of settling out west, as the corporations made many of them tenant farmers. It's our job as activists, socialists, and fighters for social justice to retell the history of these brutal campaigns. It is also our job to retain the memories of the fighters. We need to remember Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and those who fought in the past, because they can inform us in the future. The fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline and development of the largest Native resistance since the 1970s did not just happen. This is the history of the Lakota. Retaining and understanding the history of conquest and theft allow us to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline as the continuation of the march westward. The fight at Standing Rock has brought treaty rights back and gives us an opportunity right now to discuss this history of resistance. Indigenous people did not just lay down as the U.S. invaded. And the Dakota Access Pipeline and other pipelines are the new Northern Pacific Railroad. And capitalism and its thirst for more and more money and continuous growth create the conditions that for these developments. And we must not only fight against these projects, but against this whole sick system that creates this. Sitting Bull actually had a quote referencing kind of the sick system. He said, quote, "We have now to deal with another race, small and feeble when our fathers first met them, but now great and overbearing. Strangely enough, they have a mind to till the soil, and the love of possessions is a disease with them. These people have made many rules that the rich may break, but the poor may not. They have taken their tithes from the poor and weak to support the rich and those who rule." Today, those pushing for the Dakota Access Pipeline are steamrolling through Indian treaty land without concern for the earth or the people and people's land who they are invading. And much like the past, these companies want to extract, and extract for short-term profit. But the fight for sovereignty, self-determination of indigenous nations, much like the past, will put up a fight.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.